meeting with my committee, and they decided that this really, or two of them, the two hard science guys, decided that this wasn't going to work, that there was no way that I could really continue to complete the PhD program while I was working up in Salem for state government. At one point, Larry Pierce told me that it simply would not provide me with the intellectual stimulation that was required to obtain a PhD to be working in state government, and so they said they weren't going to sign off on my handbook, and that they just wanted me to take a leave of absence and think about coming back to the university. And when my alternate service was up and I was done with this job. And
now, how close, far along were you in that 2-year service
request? Oh, this would have been fairly, you know, during the first year of it.
Okay.
You know, maybe, I don't know, less than a year into the alternate service. This was after the study of handicapped education had been completed.
Were you doing coursework while you were...
Well, see, at that point, I didn't need to do any more coursework.
Okay, so
I had finished all the coursework, and, you know, under the old system, I would have been prepared to take my oral exams and then do a dissertation. But under this new system, I had to do 3 of these papers in lieu of the old oral exams. And, this was, again, part of the publisher perish era, and you know they wanted to have more things published, and of course these things need to be hard science based type things. Well, at that point, you know, when I was told that I couldn't get the intellectual stimulation that I needed, my reaction to that was sort of like, well, shove it, you know. But also, at the same time, at this point, we had moved to Salem. My wife was pregnant. It was not really very feasible for me to be thinking about going back to the university. First of all, I had to complete this 2-year commitment for the alternate service. And so I really didn't have any choice at that point than to say, okay, fine, I'll take a leave of absence and we'll sort this out later. At that point, I sort of had already decided that they could take their PhD and put it where the sun doesn't shine, you know. But that bridge had not finally been crossed at that point. But that's kind of how I was thinking. I was enjoying what I was doing for the Educational Coordinating Council. I was enjoying, being around and working with the legislature and seeing the ins and outs of state government and how things really worked, and which seemed to me like more political science than the stuff that that they were studying in the political science department in those days, and so that was fine. So I went on with my life of working for the Educational Coordinating Commission and figured I really didn't ever think I'd have any dealings with Larry Pierce or any of these people in the political science department at the University of Oregon again. But, you know, I hadn't finally burned that bridge, but I had a formal leave of absence. So at that point, I went on then I got into doing other assignments for the Educational Coordinating Council. They had a variety of things. One of the programs that they had was in response to the baby boom and the burgeoning number of undergraduates that were going into the college system. There was a much more of an interest in providing good teaching, good instruction to undergraduates, whereas the universities, particularly the University of Oregon, but to some extent Oregon State and Portland State as well, had been very much research-oriented. And you know, most of the undergraduate classes were taught by graduate assistants. You know, you'd go file 200 students into a big lecture hall, and some graduate assistant would teach them American government or economics 101 or whatever, and and there was a lot of unhappiness about that, and you know, some of which was being promoted by the smaller private independent colleges who didn't do business that way, who had faculty and their students were actually being taught by people with PhDs and professors rather than by graduate students. And so somebody had gotten a bill through the legislature to provide a grant program for grants to improve the quality of undergraduate instruction. And this was only in the public institutions. So the community colleges and the state colleges and universities were individual professors could submit grant proposals to get one of these grants to try innovative approaches to teach undergraduates, you know, using different approaches rather than graduate teaching assistants in lecture halls with 300 people. And so one of my jobs was to help out in the administration of that program. And so I went around and did a lot of interviewing and was sort of responsible for monitoring the various grants that had been given to individual professors in that program.
Would they have a course in mind or something and they'd apply?
Yeah, it was actually we did a little book about it. I've got, which the guy who was in charge of that was one of the assistant directors. And you know, there was, like, for example, one guy was an engineering professor at Oregon State who figured out that maybe it would be a good idea if engineering students were made aware of the social consequences of some of the engineering decisions that were being made. And so he basically came up with a course that sort of brought in social issues into an engineering course to sort of provide social awareness for engineering students. I forget, you know, I'd have to go back and look at my book to remember all of the different grants. But, you know, some of them were, I remember there was a couple at community colleges that were, again, trying different approaches. There was a language course that wanted to make use of more audio tapes and things like that rather than traditional foreign language instruction. And so there was an English professor, her name was Britton, I believe, that was doing some innovative things. And so one of my jobs was to help with the administration of that program, go around, do, like, every 6 months we had to go visit these programs and see what they were doing, and then at the end of the program we had to make a report back to the legislature about what we'd found. So one of my jobs was supporting that program. Another job that I got involved in was working on various surveys, studies, survey research type things. One of the things that the Educational Coordinating Council was sort of involved in at that point was trying to develop a system to look at the labor market statistics and then do a correlation between what was happening in the labor market in terms of job availability and correlate that with what was actually being taught to students in the college and university system, because you know, the idea was being, maybe it would be a good idea if we actually taught students something that could help them in the job market when they graduate. Mm-hmm. And of course, Dale Parnell, who was a, you know, member of the coordinating council at that time and was the father of community colleges in Oregon, was a big proponent of this, because obviously that's the whole community college system had been developed first and foremost to provide vocational training, but second of all to again, because of the influx of students, there simply wasn't room for the colleges and universities to take all the people that wanted to get a four-year degree. So the community colleges had developed this whole system of spending your first 2 years in a community college and then transferring to one of the four-year institutions to get your degree. And so this was a big part of the growth of community colleges. The earliest ones, Portland Community College, Chemeketa Community College in Salem, that really started out as just vocational technical schools, then expanding to provide this first 2 years of undergraduate instruction in preparation for getting a bachelor's degree in a four-year institution. Well, one of the things we were trying to do, there were a couple of people on the staff at the Coordinating Council that were statistical type people, and so we were looking at various data that we could obtain from the employment department on terms of what was happening in the job market, and then we were trying to do some studies to correlate that with what was being taught in the colleges and universities and community colleges. And of course, at that point, there was this huge tension between the people that were running the four-year college system, who look down on the community colleges, did not, they knew they couldn't really accommodate all those students that wanted to go to college, but they really looked down on certainly vocational technical education as something that was below them, and even they didn't really think very highly of the college, the first 2 years of college instruction that was being provided in the community colleges. And so they really didn't. I remember there the guy who was the vice chancellor for academic affairs for the state system of higher education was this very pompous guy named Miles Romney. He was a Dr. Miles Romney. He was a big guy, about 6'4" or something, weighed about 300 pounds, a very imposing figure. And I can still remember sitting in a meeting where he made it very clear that the department or the state system of higher education believed in what they were doing had to do with enhancing the intellectual and so forth growth of the state and of the citizens, and certainly had nothing to do with anything that was happening in the job market. and so this was sort of this was along the same lines of my friend Larry Pierce telling me that I wasn't getting any intellectual stimulation, and sort of I was getting a certain amount of enjoyment out of doing these studies of looking at labor market versus where people were getting their degrees. So one of the things that we were doing was we were doing surveys of students, both students coming out of high school and students who were graduating from the college system, to see what they were planning to do with themselves after they graduated. And the state system of higher education had this survey that they had done of high school students, graduating high school students. I remember filling it out when I was a senior in high school, of trying to find out what these students were going to do when they left high school. Now, of course, the state system of higher education's, this was a recruiting thing for them. Mm-hmm. But we sort of, at the Coordinating Council, we sort of latched on to that and started using that data to then analyze, what were students going to do after high school, and what percentage of them were going to go on to college, what percentage of them were going to go to a 2-year community college versus a 4-year college, how many of them were going to go into the military, how many of them were just going to go get jobs in the job market, and so forth. And so I got fairly involved in, this was exactly the kind of research that the political scientists were wanting to do.
Yeah, treasure trove of
information. Yeah, yeah. So I had access to all this good survey information, and one of my coworkers was a data processing guy. He helped me. I taught myself how to program in Fortran, and we ran a number of these surveys. We were using the old SPSS statistical program that I had been first introduced to in graduate school. We were using that extensively to process this survey data that we were collecting. At one point, during the time that I worked for the Educational Coordinating Council, we actually went out and did a random survey of just the general public and asking them, you know, what did they have any educational aspirations? Because again, the community colleges at this point were really trying to pull in non-traditional students. They were not looking at their market as strictly the students coming out of high school, but they were wanting to pull in adults who were interested in going back to school, veterans returning from the war in Vietnam. This is, you know, the war in Vietnam was pretty much winding down at this point. And so we went out and actually did a survey. We picked a using census tracts, we went and did a random sample of census tracts throughout the state of Oregon. We developed a questionnaire. I worked with a guy who was a graduate student at the University of Oregon, and he in turn recruited a bunch of University of Oregon students from all over the state. And so we went out and conducted this random sample survey of the public over Christmas break, and actually paid these college students to go out and administer this survey questionnaire, and then we compiled that data and printed a report, and this was sort of my initiation to really working with computers and statistical kinds of data and so forth. And this would have been sometime between 1971 and 1973. So this was prior to the personal computer. This was, everything we were doing was being done on the state's mainframe computer using the SPSS program. There were no, the personal computer hadn't even, if it had been invented, it certainly wasn't available to anybody outside of engineering schools at that point. And, you know, I still remember the first calculator that I had when I went to work at the Educational Coordinating Council was one of those old Marchant rotary calculators. I don't know if you've ever seen one of those, but it was mechanical. This, you know, there weren't even handheld calculators at this point. Mm-hmm. And so the 10-key electronic 10-key adding machines were very expensive and were just coming into vogue. And so as the junior member of the staff on my desk, I had this old Marchant calculator that was a whole series of wheels, 1 through 10. And to calculate something, it would... the little wheels would go around and around and around and around, ker-chunk, 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 to give you the result and answer. It would take, you know, it would take minutes, 15 minutes sometimes to do a fairly routine calculation. And of course, the one thing you never wanted to do was divide by zero. Mm. Because if you divided by zero, this machine just went bonkers. Mm. And then at that point, the only thing you could do would be to unplug it and start over, because it could not deal with dividing by zero.
Right.
But at any rate, it was really my time at the Educational Coordinating Council is what really got me interested in computers, and later on would lead to being one of the first people to use a PC in state government later on when I was working as a budget analyst. But I think those are really the major highlights of the time that I spent with the Educational Coordinating Council.
Sort of the methodology, survey methodology, where did you pick up that? Was that sort of...
Well, I had taken some classes first when I was at the University of Wisconsin in survey methodology, and then to some extent I had I had done some classwork on that at the U of O, and I had done some, because again, that was political science was really into that big time, and so that's. But I was sort of playing it by ear. This coworker of mine, his name was John Westine. He actually went on. He had a 30-year career in state government, basically doing the same thing that he was hired originally to do at the Educational Coordinating Council, and about he was hired shortly after I was in 1970. And he was one of the, a computer geek, and kept track of numbers and surveys and stuff. He had sort of come to this naturally because his father had been the administrator of the state employment statistics department for the state of Washington.
And he had
a PhD, Dr. John Westine. I think his PhD was in sociology or something. But he knew how to computer program and did a lot of survey analysis and that kind of thing. So he was sort of my mentor in all of this. But one of my other co-workers at the Educational Coordinating Council that came to work there after I was working there was a fellow by the name of Bernie Saalfeld. And he had a PhD from the University of Oregon in political science, but he had been working back in Washington, D.C. for the Office of Management and Budget. And for some reason, he wanted to come back to Oregon. And so he had taken this job with the Educational Coordinating Council just sort of as a way to get back to Oregon. And so very shortly, he wasn't really with the Educational Coordinating Council for very long until an opening opened up in the State Budget and Management Division, which was the sort of the state equivalent of the OMB at the federal level. And so Bernie had gone to work for the Budget Management Division as a budget analyst, and I was still, I at that point I had finished my conscientious objector obligation, decided to stay on. I had gotten a couple of fairly substantial pay increases. I remember when my pay increased from $467 all the way up to $655 a month. That had to be really negotiated very carefully with the draft board, but they finally sorted out that once the job had been approved, that they really didn't have any more say over what my pay level could be. So my friend Bob Peck sort of was my advocate for all of that, and he was the one who was the member of the draft board in McMinnville, so he got me a pay raise, which was good, because at that point, I can't remember whether that was before or after our daughter was born, but at that point, you know, I had a family. My wife really couldn't continue with her part-time work, and so we really needed the money, and at that point, I think we'd even actually bought our first house in Salem. And so we're pretty much settled in. I've decided that I was, at least for the foreseeable future, going to be a bureaucrat for the state of Oregon, and so I was plugging along, and just out of the clear blue, my friend Bernie, who had just taken a job as a budget analyst, calls and said, "We want you to come over and interview with Bob Smith. There's a budget analyst opening, and it's way too late in the whole budgetary cycle to be hiring a new budget analyst, but we've had somebody that's left unexpectedly, or that wants to leave unexpectedly, and we need to hire somebody, and can you come over and interview?" And so that was 1973, sort of right before the whole budget process, the agencies were still in the process of putting their budgets together, and then, you know, they were going to be submitted for review for the 1970 budget for the 1973-75 biennium. And so anyway, that that's probably a good place to stop for today. I don't know how far. Okay, so at any rate, I went over and had an interview with the infamous Bob Smith, Budget Bob, as he was called. At that point, again, this was in the Tom McCall administration, there were two Bob Smiths in state government. There was Bob Smith, the legislator, who was from Ontario or someplace over in Eastern Oregon, and he was one of the part of the legislative leadership, a Republican. And then there was Bob Smith, the bureaucrat, who was the head of the budget and management division of the executive department, which was this new agency that had come out of the McCall reorganizations and basically had picked up a number of the people who had been budget analysts, had worked as budget analysts for the old Board of Control. But Bob was sort of, he was a very unique individual. He had come up, he had originally come to Oregon to work for the legislative fiscal office, which was the budget staff that advises the Ways and Means Committee. But he had been hired into the executive department to be the administrator for executive budget, and had come from Los Angeles County, where he had been part of the budget structure down in Los Angeles County, which was sort of a predecessor of Oregon's system in that it hadn't, you know, Los Angeles County was this huge county in California that was very centralized, hadn't had all these boards and commission and so forth. So Bob had been in charge of staff of budget analysts down in Los Angeles County, and Bob came from a family of teachers, and he had a strong sort of sense of his role as a teacher. He also had been in the military, in the army, during the Korean War and after the Korean War, and so had a very strong sense of military organization and discipline that was part of his persona. But he was well known, you know, in the state as a really crusty, tough guy, and so I went over and had an interview with him, and he was very impressed by the fact that I had a master's degree and almost a PhD in political science, and the fact that I had done this study of special education was of some interest, because the budget analyst who at that point hadn't actually left yet, but who wanted to leave, was the guy who had been the budget analyst for the state mental health division, including all the state institutions, the state mental hospitals and so forth. And his name was Doug Collins, one of the nicest guys you'd ever meet, but he didn't really have the right personality to be a budget analyst. And so one of the things that he had been working on during the interim, while I was at the Educational Coordinating Council, he had been working on a study of the bakery at the state hospital. In the old days, the state hospital was like this totally self-sufficient community. It had its own bakery, its own butcher shop. You know, they did they farmed. They were largely self-sufficient, and the bakery at the state hospital had been retained, and they had basically ceased to bake all the bread they used to bake everything for both the state prison and the state hospital, which are located right next to each other there in Salem. But they had pretty much phased out the bread, and they were buying their bread commercially, but they still were baking all of the donuts and desserts and things, and interestingly enough, they would deliver fresh cinnamon rolls or fresh donuts to the governor's office every day, along with bouquets of fresh flowers from the greenhouse. But at any rate, somebody, I think it was Gracie Peck, Representative Gracie Peck, had some relationship with this, with the guy who was the head baker at the state hospital, and they've been trying to close down the bakery at the state hospital for several years, but Gracie was sort of the guardian angel of the state hospital baker. And so the budget management division was given the job. We had always did all the dirty work for whoever was governor at the time, was given the job to go in and do a study to show that it wasn't really economical to have the state hospital running its own bakery anymore. And so Doug had been the one, as the budget analyst for mental health, that had done this study. Well, it turned out that this guy who was the baker at the state hospital was the father of one of Doug's fraternity brothers from college. Well, Doug went in and dutifully did the study, and of course the study documented that it was not cost effective for Oregon State Hospital to run its own bakery anymore. And when the study was published, the guy who was the baker, who was Doug, the father of Doug's friend, had a heart attack. And this was devastating to Doug. He couldn't, you know, he just couldn't deal with this, and he basically went to Bob Smith and said, "I can't do this anymore. I can't be a budget analyst. I can't be responsible for these negative things that are occurring to other people, particularly the